We're back with the Tech Policy Grind. I'm Daniela Guzman Peña, a fellow with the Internet Law and Policy Foundry, the organization where the next generation of tech law and policy professionals convene to write, think, and talk about the web, technology, and disruptive innovation. This is the Tech Policy Grind, the Foundry's podcast where we chat about what's going on in the world of tech policy. Hi, everyone. It's Daniela from the Tech Policy Grind. In this week's episode, we're going back to State of the Net 2024, the premier internet policy conference in Washington, D.C. These conversations happened on the sidelines of that conference back in February, when the Foundry Fellows sat down to chat with experts to discuss AI, cybersecurity, and the future of work. First, Foundry Fellow Sasha Jovanovic and I spoke with Heather West and Charlie Snyder on the impact of AI on cybersecurity policy. Heather West is the Senior Director of Cybersecurity and Privacy Services at Venable and is a policy and tech translator, product consultant, and long-term digital strategist guiding the intersection of emerging technologies, culture, governments, and policy. Charlie Snyder serves as head of security policy at Google. In this role, Charlie leads efforts to organize Google's security expertise and technology to help solve the world's pressing challenges related to safety and security online. Before joining Google, he worked in security at Goldman Sachs Group and in multiple roles for the U.S. government. You might hear some background noise since this conversation happened in between sessions at the conference. Here's Heather, Charlie, Sasha, and me. Thank you so much, Heather and Charlie. So both just got out of the panel. How has this morning gone for you?
I think it's been fantastic. I think, unsurprisingly, there's a lot of interest about AI in general. And unsurprisingly, there's a lot of discussion about the benefits and the risks. How we can take advantage of it, but also some really important foundational discussions. What do we mean when we say AI? Is it actually new? What is the impetus and the catalyst for all of these conversations? It's not that we've never done this before. It's not that we have just come up with artificial intelligence from whole cloth. So what is it actually?
Yeah, I would say the grounding has really been great to hear, you know, keeping the conversation grounded in reality. And I think what else stood out, as Heather already mentioned, is we've spent a year plus now kind of grappling with, you know, this explosion of LLMs and generative AI, spending a lot of time focusing on the risks. And it's we need to do that. We have to continue doing that. But it's been great hearing folks that are also optimistic about how AI can potentially help solve problems.
Right. And I'd love to dig a little bit deeper into that. So there's been a lot of buzz about the risks of AI and the vulnerabilities of AI, how bad actors can leverage this technology to create chaos. But your panel really spoke about sort of the impact of AI on the cybersecurity world from the perspective of what AI can do to protect users. So could both of you kind of give me some examples of some AI-powered tools that are being used currently in the cybersecurity world to protect users, you know, either from a privacy standpoint, from a data protection standpoint, from, you know, making sure that bad actors are deterred from even accessing our information. What are some of those examples that we have currently?
Sure, I'm happy to list some. We've been very keen to identify the types of tasks that kind of the newer AI systems are well geared towards. I think for years, I would say more than a decade, we have applied at Google machine learning and associated technologies to challenges like threat detection. I think that's a really common example, you know, where machine learning is really well suited to, you know, receiving an input of a large amount of heterogeneous data and identifying within that you know, which are the, you know, tiny pieces of signal, which are the threats within that that we need to detect and stop. So that's been integrated in things like Gmail for over a decade. But with generative AI and large language models, we're seeing all these new use cases open up. In the same way that, you know, people all over the world are interacting with generative AI to, you know, help summarize a complex topic or write for them something that will make a task easier, we are seeing the same use cases applied for cybersecurity defenders to make their jobs easier. So internally, we have incident response teams that are, you know, when something is detected within our environment, they need to, you know, write up a summary of it, pulling in all of this, you know, these different data sets about, you know, what kind of, you know, telemetry and different bugs and things like that. And we are using generative AI to quickly pull together all the relevant data to generate quick summaries of an incident to enable faster decision making. And with our early experiments that we're actually using in the real world, it is allowing our incident response teams to perform about 50% faster than before. So that's just one example of new use cases that are really opening up with generative AI.
I think it's worth, you know, we do talk a lot about how AI can throw a wrench into things and really be a security threat, a cybersecurity threat, and what it might change or what it might amplify. But when we're talking about chaos, you know, AI is actually pre-ordered chaos. At the end of the day, its job is to tell us what's out of norm, what's an anomaly, and detect something weird, or to make a prediction. And that's really creating order out of chaos. And so, yes, it can be used in all sorts of chaotic or chaos-inducing ways, or chaotic ways. But it's also actually this incredible tool. It's not, you know, LLMs aren't giving us a jumble of words. It's not actually creating chaos. It's organizing them in such an interesting way. And as Charlie is saying, it can really supercharge some of these days and tasks. But I do think that it's useful to remember that AI is already facilitating these interactions, and they're really based on the ability of AI to create that. We don't necessarily appreciate it because when it works, we don't notice it. So that these tools are really everywhere and protecting us and making our lives easier. And so thinking about which pieces of that we want to amplify and how we want to make sure that these tools are, you know, doing the things you want them to do is a big piece of that puzzle, and that's order to chaos too.
Yeah, I love that framing of how AI can both be a tool for chaos, but it can also put order to chaos. And some of this decision-making AI technology that we've been seeing is really interesting because it's been used in the cyber security industry and space for so long. And I think now it's just starting to emerge as sort of a mainstream technology in other areas and other industries as well. Sasha Jovanovic, who's also a Foundry Fellow, is here with me. And Sasha, I know you wanted to ask a little bit about, you know, some of the ways that bad actors might be using and evolving these tools to sort of, you know, take advantage of some of the vulnerabilities in these emerging technologies. Do you have anything else that you wanted to sort of ask Charlie and Heather about in relation to that?
Yeah, I think in your panel, mostly you mentioned that the volume has increased a lot with AI. It's just easier to have a greater volume of talks and maybe time frame. But how have the techniques changed as well from an educational perspective?
I would say so far here, or maybe just to back up for the listeners, you know, we spoke on the panel about we are seeing bad actors really use AI for two different purposes. So first, information operations, generating inauthentic content for the purposes of influencing people. And we are seeing a lot of use of that, although much of that has not been very effective. The other thing we're seeing a lot is use of LLMs to help with social engineering, to essentially hack people. So develop more convincing lures for the phishing email, for example. And, you know, what both of those cases have in common is, you know, LLMs are well suited for something that requires natural language. And so if you're a you know, foreign speaker and you want to write either a phishing message or some sort of propaganda that's targeting someone in a different language, very well suited for that. We're seeing it. One thing I would say is we have not seen many cases, or maybe any cases, where we are seeing AI help attackers do things they couldn't do before. Like, phishing is a well-known problem. There are well-known defenses for it. And if companies and users, you know, apply the steps that we know that work to prevent phishing, I think we have pretty high confidence that those types of attacks would not be successful. So things like applying multi-factor authentication. What we're not seeing yet, what we're very interested in, from a research perspective, from a threat information channel perspective, is AI helping attackers do things that they couldn't do things? You know, inventing new forms of attacks, and I think that kind of remains to be seen.
And when you think about this social engineering side of things, I mean, it's one thing for AI tools and cybersecurity to protect the actual device and to protect data, but when it comes to people and their perception of reality, that gets into very gray, tricky territory. And when generative AI is advancing as quickly as it is, deep fakes are becoming closer to reality than ever. How do you think that AI can sort of help either detect or even deter AI deepfake technology that could be leveraged by bad actors to really get inside of the minds of users and really, you know, prey on their vulnerabilities in terms of what they perceive as reality?
Good question, and we're talking about the things that we're not necessarily as a society well equipped to figure out right this second. It is the human element. You know, are these materials that are generated particularly convincing? They might be sometimes they're not. I think this works for example, imagery right now. If they have five fingers, it's probably real, because turns out like creating hands is really hard. Now, granted, when I tried to draw, I can't draw hands, so no matter. But I do reliably get five fingers on a hand. I think that there's a question there too. You know, what is the purpose of these debates? And sometimes it is. Do we want to fool people? Yes, maybe. And we're going to see a lot of that over the next year, I think, in the U.S. and elsewhere, as we are looking at, you know, elections and particularly conversations that are intended to be persuasive. But there's a lot of conversation happening around that as well. One of the things that someone else said on our panel was talking about how generationally some folks are better equipped to think about, is this real? Last night in the Super Bowl, the number of times someone pointed at the screen and said, wait, was that AI? It was at least 10 times. And yes, there was a lot of AI and a lot of computer-generated imagery, which has been around for a long time, but it was more top of mind. And so I'm going to put on my optimist hat and say that...
We love the optimist hat.
People are more aware of it now, and people are thinking harder. And that means that there is a little bit more well equipped as humans to think about the deep fakes and the synthetic content. But there's also a lot of work happening in any number of places, the government and companies, to think about how do we validate content.
I mean, I too have the optimist mindset. I think my last role in the government before I went into private industry, I was. You know, I was in the government during the 2016 presidential elections. Election hacking and hacking league operations there that did play an important role in that presidential election. I think we are so far evolved from the way society was back then. I think if you're thinking positively, we would say we are more resilient to things like that. I think negatively, I think a lot more people are cynical about, you know, things that they see on the internet. But I do think we have made some progress there, shielding, you know, helping people be more resilient to those forms of content. You know, for a company perspective that produces these tools, you know, we break it down, and this is somewhat of a stereotype in the tech world. You know, it is a, you know, a people, process, and technology problem. I think operationally, we are very focused on, one, providing tools to flag inauthentic content as it might be introduced on our platforms, flag it as quickly as possible, give people tools to identify it, and then internally action it quickly. On the technology front, we are working, and I think this is kind of the cutting edge of research for companies that produce generative AI solutions, working on things like watermarking tools. We released a tool called SynthID, which is able to watermark images and now text, actually. And so seeing if there might be a technology component of this that can help. You know, people are going to use our tools to produce content, making sure that it comes with some ability to trace it, where it came from, and is it real or not real. And then I think, you know, to Heather's point, people is the biggest piece of it. And I think that gets into societal scale education and skills efforts to help people, you know, identify and think critically about things that they're seeing online.
I think following that on both the panel and a little earlier, you mentioned that infodumps are actually less effective at spreading propaganda, as maybe a lot of people, at least in the media, have been talking about in the lead up to the next election cycle in the U.S. and everywhere around the world. And so I was just wondering if you can speak more to why maybe the risk to you seems less than how people are perceiving it.
Well, I think partially for things we've just discussed, that I do think society is more resilient to these things now, or maybe more cynical about content being shared on the internet. I think if you look at the example, for instance, of Taiwan, which recently had an election where a rival power had every incentive to use this technology to try to sway the results of the election, and were ultimately unsuccessful. I'm not an expert on those political dynamics there, but I think, you know, that was a case where people were expecting worse things to happen in the information domain than actually happened. And hopefully, you know, I think we and other companies are learning lessons from that and helping to, you know, further bolster our kind of, you know, the tools we offer to again make society more resilient to these types of things.
I think one more question to wrap this up. In the content moderation space, you see a lot of this partnership between AI tools in detection of, you know, violative behavior like hate speech or misinformation, and a human review. So a human in the loop kind of, you know, tagging on to something that is detected by AI tooling and then sort of confirming that something is violative. Is this process something that came out of the cybersecurity world, like this technology and human-in-the-loop partnership, or is it something that's being used in cybersecurity, sort of taken from the content moderation space? I'm curious how the two industries have sort of played on that and influence each other, if you will.
Heather probably has a broader purview than I do. At Google, we have very robust both security operations teams and trust and safety teams. The latter tend to be the ones that are focused on kind of content moderation and content safety issues. It strikes me that there are a lot of similarities, and you know, the trust and safety field is relatively newer than the cybersecurity field, and so I do think there was a lot of learning there, but I suspect the answer is going to be different depending on the organization.
Yeah, I think that's right. My suspicion is that it was formalized in the content space after it was formalized in the cybersecurity space, but I say that fairly loosely, because part of this is that cybersecurity professionals bring healthy paranoia to the picture. Did my digital system, did my AI, although we weren't necessarily calling it that, did they do it right? Trust but verify, because we always expect some level of failure, and that's just built into the system. And so whether we're checking it with a human system or whether we're checking it with some redundant system, I think there is an ethos of, like, let's make sure that's right. I think that there is a real value in having a human in the loop for a lot of things, but it's also worth remembering that humans aren't always right either. Yeah. And so building those redundancies in is probably something that we're taking directly from the cybersecurity space. It's also just from the software engineering space where you want your stuff to work. And to do that, you can't just take one shot at it.
Thank you so much, Heather and Charlie, for being with us today. And hopefully we can get you on another episode of the podcast to talk more about this. There's so much to talk about. So appreciate your time.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you both.
At the conference, I also spoke with Dr. Athena Kanyura, Chief Strategy and Transformation Officer at PepsiCo, after a panel she participated in at the conference called AI at Work, Preserving Worker Dignity in Workplace Hiring, Management, and Compensation. She told me more about the work Pepsi is doing to leverage AI to support and upskill workers in the manufacturing industry. Here's Athena.
Hi, Athena. Thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you, Daniela. And I would like to welcome also the visitors of the podcast in the great session that I will have with Daniela today, discussing PepsiCo's efforts on AI and digital transformation. So, as PepsiCo, we have a very clear mission when it comes to using technology and AI, and that is empowering our consumers, empowering our employees, and making sure we do that responsibly for the society and the communities that we operate. And why is this critical? Because as PepsiCo, we are in every single household. It's products are beloved by everyone, like Cheetos, Doritos, Gatorade, Pepsi, Quaker, and therefore our consumers expect from us that when we use technology, we do it in a very responsible way, ensuring that we abide by privacy, data, laws that occur in the locations that they operate, but also we give them the right to decide how they want to engage with us. So the first thing that, as we are thinking about AI, is what is the consumer framework that we use AI for to engage with consumers from the design of the product down to the sales cycle of the product. So the whole consumer lifetime value, consumer engagement, and direct-to-consumer ecosystem. Then it's how we engage with our customers, with our retailers. How do we engage with them in a way that when you go and find your product, you will say, okay, yeah, I can find it at the moment that I want, for the price that I want, in the store that I want. So we have a motto of always everywhere. This always everywhere can be only achieved if we embed ML, machine learning, and AI logic on how we sell, how we monitor inventory, how we ensure we don't have stockouts in the value chain. So you always find the product at the store at any given point in time. The third big area where we use AI is in logistics and operations. So as a company, we have the second biggest fleet in the U.S. I mean, our truck drivers drive their trucks across the whole vicinity of the U.S. to move the products from one location, from our warehouses to the store. So we use AI for health and safety, for monitoring truck performance, for route optimization, and ensuring they know exactly where to go at a given point in time with the best possible efficiency. Then the other big area where we use AI is in our manufacturing facilities, our plants. And there is about providing predictive asset maintenance, safety around quality and control, ensuring our plant managers have full visibility of all the production lines, and everything that is running in the facilities is at the maximum utilization and true efficiency.
So there's so many ways that AI is being leveraged by PepsiCo, from the consumer interface to your manufacturing workforce to the way that PepsiCo actually hires and retains its workers. Today at State of the Net, you were on a panel discussing AI at work and how you preserve workers' dignity in the era of AI. a lot of people are concerned about how AI might be sort of taking over jobs that were traditionally for people and working class people. So I'm really interested to hear a little bit more about this white paper that is being published and released today by the Aspen Institute, and how PepsiCo contributed to this research, and really what is the objective of the research that you're doing to sort of see how AI can be deployed to preserve worker dignity.
Yeah, that's wonderful, Daniela. And for us, the partnership with Aspen has been extremely successful because it materialized to a working paper that can be used across all different aspects of manufacturing. And not just the big manufacturers, but also the smaller manufacturers. Let me explain what was the trigger for the partnership and then what was the outcome of the study. We as PepsiCo, as I said, we did a lot to be able to drive AI at scale. And 3 years ago, we said we cannot do that without bringing our employees along on the journey. Not just as the end user, but also as part of the design process. So as we were thinking of the user experiences and the building of the AI applications, we said we need to have our fleet managers with us when we design applications for the fleet. We need to have our plant managers with us as we design applications for manufacturing. So with that, we said, okay, we now need them to be upskilled in AI systems, data-driven systems, why we need cloud infrastructure, what's a digital backbone. So therefore, they can understand the value of the system and be an ambassador for the change from within. So they didn't see that as another technology, but as a core enabler for them to do their job better and have, at the end of the day, better quality of jobs. So as we collected all those testimonials from our employees and we showed them in action as they were using the technology, we invited Aspen to document that. So they went and had interviews with the different parts of our businesses, show in action how the applications are being used, had panels to understand impact on their job, positive or negative, being able to document the risks and the opportunities, because at the end of the day, what we both collectively wanted to do is create a platform for the Manufacturing Association to be able to provide, especially for Tier 2 and Tier 3 manufacturers, a way to drive change using AI models without heavily investing up front in the technology infrastructure. One is to convince. It's not a dream, it's a reality. Second is to allow everyone to see that it creates more jobs. It doesn't create more jobs. Third, to use PepsiCo as a platform for the infrastructure, but also the know-how to educate the rest of the manufacturers on what can be done and how it can be done, not just with enormous budgets, but with smart budgeting.
Thank you so much. And you mentioned that the paper documents some of the risks of the application of this technology in the manufacturing sector. And one of those risks is sort of that this new technology requires upskilling in new skill sets, and that requires a workforce that has those capabilities, but that workforce doesn't necessarily exist yet because this technology is still developing. So what are some of the ways that PepsiCo is thinking about sourcing and hiring when it comes to really making sure that you're not leaving this workforce behind as you apply this new technology?
We have two strategies. One is continuous learning of our existing employee base, and the second is how do we ensure the talent that we attract from the outside is also fit for purpose, right? Because as you develop and evolve, you also need to bring, I would say, next generation of talent to be able to source some of those technologies within the organization. I have to tell you, what I have seen so far has impressed me in a very positive way, because there isn't one person outside right now, and let's take the U.S. as an example, who is not digital savvy in their day-to-day life. Right? I mean, it's like children are using Gen AI for homework. Grandparents are using Gen AI for shopping. Mothers are using Gen AI for healthcare. So we believe that the democratization of AI and what is happening right now actually creates a common platform for everyone to be personally upskilled and reskilled, but also now for organizations to build on the personal experiences of what every citizen has based on how they are using Gen AI and AI in their daily lives. So we have been doing two things. One is we have created what we call a major and a minor. So it's like university, pretty much. We are treating that as a curriculum in university. We are mapping everyone's career, not just where they are, but where they want to be. They say, okay, based on your career aspiration, this is the type of upskilling and skilling you need to be able to reach that aspiration. Some of it is foundational training, some of it is hands-on, on-the-job training to be able to deliver that aspiration. And what we have seen per the data, 90% of the employee base actually can reach that aspiration, as with that level of certification. There is always going to be a small percentage that we will not be able to take them. And that we need to find different ways to protect and find jobs. Right? It's not like suddenly we have to eliminate that part, but there will always be more manual processes that we can they can leverage. The second element, which for us is very critical, when it comes to the employees that we bring from the outside, especially when it comes to hiring, we don't use AI for hiring. Because we believe AI is very good for the latter part of the employee experience, which is the skills matching, which is identifying the gaps, the talent, but not identification, because there is inherent bias in the population available when it comes to hiring techniques. So we have a talent acquisition team that does the first step of the identification of the candidates, and then AI systems are being used much more to amplify that profile, but not to do the first step.
That's really interesting to hear that the AI technology is being employed at the latter end of the employment process. So not in the hiring stage, but actually in the retention and upward mobility stage of the employment cycle. One question I had about this paper that just got released today is it's a guide for other manufacturers, and PepsiCo is really blazing a path for other manufacturing industries and companies to deploy AI and at the same time preserve worker dignity. What is the number one recommendation to sort of mitigate risk of some of these workers being left behind by the deployment of automation that you would recommend to other industry leaders who are in the manufacturing sector that would like to take on this technology but are really worried about the disparate impact that it might have on their workers?
One is facts have shown that those employees can be upskilled. So believe that the chance can become a reality. So that's always the criticism, right? Can those employees be upskilled and skilled? Yes, they can. So that's fact number one. Fact number two, there is also this myth it's so expensive to upskill and reskill. It's not. I mean, when we started building the Bristol Academy, what we did is we synthesized content that was already available out there. Some of it we have created internally. Some of them is like online courses that are free of charge, and then we created a bespoke Digital Academy for the people. And the third one is like, oh, it will take time out of their daily schedule. You cannot imagine how many of them did the training, the site, the weekends. We allowed them, of course, we have specific slots of the day in the work life, but it didn't take anything out of their daily job. The opposite, from the moment where they were upskilled, it drove everything from 10 to 70% more productivity and efficiency out of what they were doing. So, it has not just an impact on the people and giving back to their employees, but an impact, financial impact, positive financial impact in top line and bottom.
That's incredible to hear, both about the business benefit as well as the individual benefit to the worker, who is also improving possibly their upward mobility and their chances at a better livelihood because they're gaining these skills. Thank you so much, Athena. It was wonderful to talk to you, and hopefully we'll continue to discuss this on a longer episode of the Tech Policy Grind in the future.
Thank you, Daniela, for being an excellent host.
Thank you.
The Tech Policy Grind podcast was created by the fellows at the Internet Law and Policy Foundry. It's produced and edited with support from Foundry Fellow, editor, and co-executive producer, Evan Enzer, and myself, Daniela Guzman-Pena. I and other Foundry Fellows engage with the Foundry voluntarily and in our personal capacities. The views and opinions expressed on air do not reflect on the organizations we are affiliated with. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Tech Policy Grind podcast. Be sure to check out the Foundry on LinkedIn and Twitter. And if you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review and give us a 5-star rating. It really helps out the show. If you're interested in supporting the show, reach out to us at foundrypodcasts@ilpfoundry.us. You can find our email in the show notes as well. Special thanks to Sasha, Heather, Charlie, and Athena for their collaboration and support in bringing this episode to air. See you next time.